Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do modern and traditional music owe to Alan Lomax? Beginning when he was just a teenager, Lomax traveled the American South with his father, John, collecting samples of folk and blues music from prisons, plantations, parlors, and porches. These scrupulously recorded lyrics and melodies were not so much performance pieces as integral expressions of the rhythm of everyday life. Later, Lomax would travel Europe and the Caribbean as well in search of the places where music traditions were born and of the fascinating results when different sounds and ideas were blended together into something new. John Swed is professor of music and jazz studies at Columbia University. He explores Lomax's life story in his new book, Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World. John, welcome to Think.
Hi, glad to be here.
You knew and worked with Alan Lomax, and you write that his life was not an easy one to love. Can you tell us a little bit about what he was like as a person?
The first thing, I suppose, is that he, except for a small period of his life, never had a regular paycheck. When he worked for the Library of Congress briefly between 38 and 1941, I believe, he did have a check, but it was about the level of a day laborer. It was a very poor-paying job and seldom rose above that. For the rest of his life, he was a freelancer, to put it in a nice way, and sometimes had no money at all, was often broke, had really no money left at the time he died. So life was hard for him in that sense. He had chosen that life. His life was could be called bohemian. His father called it being bums because his father had a similar experience, although he'd had a period of time at the University of Texas and at Texas A&M and some proper jobs along the way. Except for a moment where he was a banker in the Dallas Bank, he was broke for his life, too, and was also hustling the rest of his life. So the family was, despite a few moments, a poor family, and that was a bad start.
And you almost have to begin a discussion of Alan Lomax with a little history on his father, John, who grew up in North Texas and as a child was enchanted by cowboy music.
Mm. Yes, he was born right next to the Chisholm Trail. And he often, I can't say he dressed like a cowboy, but he had a big Stetson, which he used like a cowboy might. He dressed otherwise in a suit and made what money he made when he wasn't working for the universities as a lecturer on various circuits. But lecturer doesn't quite get it. He was a very colorful man with, you have to imagine him appearing before a group of academics who were all dressed in dinnerware, tuxedos and evening gowns and so forth. And this guy with the big hat comes in, and the first thing he does is let out some kind of cattle cry, which shocks the whole group for, I'm sure, for more than a minute, and told long stories about Texas. And he came out of that tradition of, which is particularly strong in Texas, of telling tales about neighbors, about people from different parts of the state, and doing them dramatically and turning them into performance pieces, just as they memorized poetry and song in the same way. In fact, curious thing about that family is they didn't seem to draw, maybe not just that family, but of people of that time, they didn't draw a line between folk song, folklore, and high culture, and they memorized passages from Shakespeare and tales and mixed them all together. It was all, for them, kind of oral literature.
You know, it's almost hard to conceive this, John, in 2011, but early in his academic career, John Lomax struggled to convince his peers that there was value to studying folk music.
Yes, and there's something, now that you say it, I hadn't thought of before, and that is that the only place in the U.S. that you could, I'm thinking now pre-1950, that you could find any kind of academic or sustained interest in folklore as a subject would have been at Harvard in Cambridge and to a little bit in New York later on. But the Harvard tradition goes back to James Russell Lowell, goes through Longfellow, up into the teachers that that Lomax had, Lomax Sr. had, and Jr. when they went to Harvard. What's odd, is, and I just thought of, is that University of Texas at that time had a sort of unstated priority of hiring people from Harvard. So it seems odd to me there would have been resistance to it when John Sr. went to one of his teachers, the English department, and showed him this large collection of cowboy songs he had, and he was told that they were trash to get rid of them. And in fact, he said he burned them that day in disgust and anger.
Yeah, he'd been collecting them like on these big scrolls, right, for years and years.
Mm-hmm. And the one serious collector of songs before him, Cecil Sharp, who came from England and worked a lot in Kentucky and a few other places for a year, he had singled out, and for that matter, even the academic folklorists, who were the people who worked with the library collections, had singled out cowboy songs as corruptions of the ballad tradition. Mm-hmm. The cowboys had let their own culture, I'm kind of a paraphrase here, destroy the beauty of the songs. So to walk in with cowboy songs, of all things, was waving a red flag.
So, meanwhile, John Lomax gets married and starts a family relatively late in life, we should say. And although his son Alan was sort of sickly and would not have been perceived to be the star of that family, there was something about him that made him his father's favorite son.
I've never been entirely clear on that. They had great aspirations for him. His older brother, John, was an enormous success in everything he did. Banking, he was himself a folklorist, he performed, he was the star of everybody's handsome guy. And Alan was quirky, and his father tried very hard to make him into what he called a Texas man, which would be a guy who spent summers down in the Brazos, you know, helping make farm roads or shoveling something or other, and he just wasn't physically suited to it. And at the same time, his father would be sending him adult-type books to read, the stories of famous Texans and what have you, and quizzing him on them in the mail. So it's a strange way to get started, and a way in which you would think a son would grow up to hate the subject that his father pioneered. But it didn't work out that way. And to me, I guess the only way I can make sense of it is that somehow or other that he came to understand the importance of folk song in a way that his father understood it, so that he held nothing against him in that. They certainly disagreed politically, and
Alan Lomax had communist sympathies. Is that right?
It's hard to say what he had, because I should introduce here the fact that the FBI followed him for 30 years and passed on papers to the London police, to Spain, to Italy, to France, to have him checked out as he went. But nothing was ever concluded. Nothing was ever shown to be wrong in his career, but it was more than that. Every year, almost every year, the FBI record shows that somebody would say, this man is guilty of nothing, let's drop this. And then it would be picked up again, and they'd repeat the whole process again, on and on. But so I'll go with the FBI. They never said he was a communist. They just went looking for it. My thinking is that Alan was too undisciplined to ever walk any party line, Republican, Democrat, communist, union, whatever. There was always something more important, and that something was the song and talk of people, which often wasn't what parties and clubs want to hear.
Did Alan and John Lomax talk about music when, starting in the early 30s, they traveled together recording things around the American South? What kinds of conversations do you know that they had about what they were doing?
Well, I have, there's some notebooks in Austin at the University Library that go into some detail about this, and some letters. They argued a great deal about the implications of it all, and they were so public about this that they actually, at one point, father and son published the article with the same name. It's very confusing if you don't look closely, in different places. It looks like it's the same article, but when you read it, you find they're on opposite sides of the fence. They're talking about folklore and folk song in the prisons, and his father in that... And his article accuses his son of romanticizing the situation of the prisoners and saying that Alan would be happy if he could turn loose all the prisoners at Sugar Land. And he also says that Alan was always disappointed to find out that black people actually had owned land and had farms. Alan accuses his father of being a romantic in his article of the same name, and says that his father is always trying to find, literal romanticism from literature among black communities. I found a letter where they sort of confronted each other on this years later, and both of them were sort of saying, did I say that? So I put this down partly to parental and child antagonisms that sometimes, at some point, gets embarrassing to each other.
One thing that is certain is that they, if not discovered, introduced to the world, someone that we now know as Leadbelly, Huddy Leadbetter, when he was at Angola Prison in Louisiana. Before we talk about it, let's just listen to a recording.
Yon come a misery, oh yeah, tiny, what do you know? Well, I know about a bar, and it's just she wore umbrella on the shoulder, feed the paper in her hand. Well, I'm going in at the governor, he's trying to lose her mind.
That is Leadbelly, a recording taken by Alan Lomax. And by the way, everything that we're going to play today is available at the website of the Library of Congress, and we're about to put a link on our website so you can find those things easily. Leadbelly is an interesting case. How many people had they listened to before they heard him singing?
They'd been through a number of prisons. The idea of going to prisons is not the only thing they did when they first went out together. Alan had gone to Harvard for a year, and although his grades were perfectly decent, they weren't enough to qualify him for a scholarship, which would pay for all of his expenses. That was the only way he could have stayed there. The story spread has been spread that he got into political troubles and demonstrations, which is true, but that was not what the problem was there. So his father also was getting sickly and wasn't able to carry the equipment they needed to couldn't even drive, for that matter. So Alan volunteered that rather than going to the University of Texas, where the fees were way lower, that he would go out with his father and help him for what turned out to be for 2 years, running on a grant that passed through, I believe, from the Carnegie Foundation to the Library of Congress, using just the as a funnel to get the money to come to them. And they lived like hobos, sleeping in tents and what have you, going from place to place, and they'd have to dress up when they got to prisons, and they'd always keep one suit and so forth, and sometimes even check into some kind of place where they could take showers and show up presentably. And they were often turned away at prisons because they were considered nuisances, and it was also an era in which prison reform was beginning to be felt, and everyone who came to visit prisons was viewed as a potential threat to the order that they had there. So it was no easy job of getting in there, but they thought it was important because they thought the prisoners were less inundated by the new media of recordings and radio, which was now everywhere, and that somehow they would retain their older traditions. Then two things they found out about that. The first was that the white prisoners weren't so inclined to sing collectively or solo as the black singers, but also that they had actually been affected by radio and so on in various ways. Leadbelly had served a sentence at
Angola.
Sugarland first.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sugarland first.
Sugarland for murder.
You know, let me have you pause. John, let me have you pause there. We're going to take a quick break, and I want to make sure we get time to tell the whole story. John Swed is my guest. He's professor of music and jazz studies at Columbia University. He's also author of the new book, Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to get on the line to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Hello,
That is Hobart Smith performing Sourwood Mountain, another recording taken by Alan Lomax. We are speaking this hour with John Swed, professor of music and jazz studies at Columbia University. His new book is called Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World. Before the break, John, you were telling us that Lead Belly had first served time in Sugarland Prison.
Yeah, I'm sorry for being long-winded.
It's fine.
The Lead Belly story has been mythologized so much, I try to be careful about it. He was considered a very dangerous man, but prison authorities thought of him as a model prisoner. So he had sung songs for inmates at formal events and for staff and for the governor, Governor Neff at the time, and had actually won his freedom on the basis of a song aimed at the governor to get him out. Got him out on not a pardon, but a reduced time. Hmm. It's something like those stories of, 1,001 Nights, keep singing and you can stay alive kind of thing. So he was back in prison for attempted murder, this time now in Louisiana at Angola Prison, where the Lomaxes could not find at the time as many singers as they thought they would find there. But this one person stood out, both physically and his apparent strength, and despite being an older man, and like a rock, like Tom Waits said, like a tree, like the Rosetta Stone, everything that was to come. And he radiated total confidence in what he knew and how he presented himself, so he couldn't be ignored. And that's where they first recorded him on a very cheap machine and then made a point of coming back much later. And then, as it turned out, he tried the same thing again to get out with a recording made for him and went for the governor. This didn't work in Louisiana, but it turns out he got out on good time again shortly after. However, he always thought that he did get out by singing, and the Lomaxes thought so too until they found out later. But by and large, the story was so good and so popular with the press, with film news like March of Time and so forth, that story spread all across the country and still sticks with him. So he got out not by singing the second time, but by just good behavior.
I want to pick up on something you just mentioned, that initially they had a very cheap machine, they went back with a better one. They were both really committed to getting the best sounding recordings. And at the time, in the 1930s and 40s, this wasn't like taking a little Marantz recorder and sticking a microphone somewhere. These were huge, hundreds of pounds of equipment. Is that right?
That's right. And they tried starting with a machine given to them by Edison's widow, which is basically something like what used to be called a dictaphone, the worst kind of sound that lasted only a minute and it was only good for speech. So they realized that was really not adequate. But when the first disc recorders came out that were anywhere near portable, and by portable I mean under 500 pounds, but certainly over 350 pounds, they had to drag these things all over the place, along with the sound sources, with the energy sources, which were portable batteries very often, because they couldn't count on any kind of source, and the disc, which were often glass and very heavy. So it was a true chore to do this, and it's what young Alan did at 17 when he was dragging these things around.
What interest did Alan Lomax have in analyzing the music that he heard?
This is another point of difference between he and his father, I think. His father was interested, like most academics and maybe most people were, in the words and what they told them. This is the way that folklore had been studied for maybe a century and understood, back starting with Sir Walter Scott and that sort of person in Scotland and Northern England. And Alan had a fascination with style differences, the difference between different kinds of singers and so forth. And he tells of finding a little speakeasy is probably too fancy a word for it, but a place where homemade liquor or legal liquor was sold to college students by an African-American woman who was also a blues singer and entertained the students while they drank her hooch at her place. And Alan was thrilled by this crossing the line experience and taking friends along with him. Took his first wife along with him, as it turns out, this kind of thing. And then also going to record stores, which were... It wasn't that they were segregated. They were just highly niche-oriented. So if you wanted to hear black music, you had to go to a black store. If you wanted straight music, you went to a white store. But if you wanted folk music by white people, like hillbillies and the like, it was virtually impossible to get except in furniture stores. So what I'm getting at is that most people had not heard anything approaching what we know to be the range of music in the United States in the 1930s, at least.
Did Alan Lomax have concerns about, on the one hand, he found this amazing music and he wanted to share it with the world, but then there's the question of, does it stay pure after it's explored and understood and then performed before these very diverse audiences?
Well, I think there are two ways he would think of it. First of all, he was not the purist that he appeared to be at times, because he certainly talked that way. He'd been a DJ, after all, for Mutual Radio, and appeared with the DJs, by DJ I mean people who play records on the radio, and this is a period in which DJs were sinking in popularity, and Mutual Radio decided that they would get celebrity DJs and pay them big money. Duke Ellington, for example, was making $3,000 a week in the late 40s, a lot of money to do a show. And Alan got one of these shows. And if you look at his playlist, it's true he played some pretty raw recordings, including his own, but he also had Joe Stafford, who was, until very recently, the biggest selling female artist in the history of pop music, and playing jazz, playing pop tunes. In fact, He was even sticking in things from recent soundtracks of movies. Robert Mitchum singing Calypso, really awful music, but I'm sure it fascinated people. So he had this side. I'd call him a sort of populist, cultural populist, maybe. He wanted to reach everybody. So there is a sort of contradiction there, but I think he resolved it. He wanted to have the best of what the raw stuff was, what he called music with a bark on it. And he wanted it recorded in the highest quality so it would compete with the rest of the medium. But he also was interested in the way these things affected other people and other musics.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Paul in Hearst. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I was stationed in England from 1953 through 55. And at Edinburgh Music Festival, I ran into the Theatre Royal East with Joan Littlewood and Ewan McCall and some others. Anyway, I would go to the theatre. They were so poor, all the actors lived in the theatre, including Joan Littlewood and Jerry Raffles. And when I was there one weekend, I supplied the theatre with cigarette, American cigarettes, which they were delighted with. But in any case, When I was there one weekend, Alan Lomax and another person came through, and they had a kind of playoff competition, whatever instrument Alan Lomax played between two Brits and these two Americans. And at the end of the playoff, one was a big bass fiddle and a couple guitars and such. The Brits wanted to call it a draw. It wasn't a big argument or anything, but the Americans, that is, Alan Lomax and another person, wanted to have the jury, so to speak, Joan Littlewood and a couple others, to say who she and Jerry thought were the better. And I was just wondering if he had that competitive nature, if that was true to him, at least by a shred.
Paul, thanks so much for your call. This must have been John, the skiffle group that Alan Lomax put together. Is that right?
Sounds a little earlier than that. This is the first person I've ever talked to who saw Lomax in that kind of setting. This is great to hear. I'm betting that Alan played guitar, and I'm betting he had Ramblin' Jack Elliott with him, who was also involved with several theater projects. They had a thing called the Big Rock Candy Mountain, a musical, kind of fantasy musical that Alan had written and been produced by Joan Littlewood, as he's talking about there. Ramblin' Jack Elliott was a Brooklyn physician's son who took up the Woody Guthrie style. So that sounds to me like what was going on there. Well, Alan, in fact, often encouraged competitive situations, even when they were catastrophic. When he was connected to the Newport Festival, on one occasion where he was chiefly in charge of what happened, he managed to stage some kind of competition for all the parts that he was connected with. One of them was a blues competition between three or four of the greatest blues singers, And his favorite of the lot, Son House, he always thought it was a genius and a philosopher. Son House didn't want to do this and got drunk beforehand, so he couldn't perform. I mean, that's my best guess at it, because he certainly was beyond performing. And he had these people sitting there like a jury who didn't want to reward the prize, and it was very awkward. On the other hand, when he had gospel quartets competing, if I recall correctly, it was the Swan Silvertones and I'm forgetting the other group. These were groups who were used to sort of church competitions where they would be invited two groups at once by a church group to perform on, say, on a Sunday afternoon. And it was the most spectacular thing I've ever seen, because they not only competed to see who was the best, but then they got into a kind of musical exchange in which they started by switching. Let's say one would sing four bars and the other would sing a few lines and the other would sing. Then the lines got shorter and shorter and shorter. And then they were down to single sounds like I, you, whatever. And they were throwing the mic back and forth. And so it would get there just in time to get the part in. It was astonishing. But the blues thing was a catastrophe, I have to say. So his idea that the competition would bring out the best didn't seem to work for everybody.
Let's talk about a little bit about the time that he spent in Europe. We have something here called the Copper Plate Reel, which I selected for one because it sounds so very raw, and you can hear a lot of the charm of the recording is the sound of someone dancing in the background. Let's listen. That is Seamus Ellis and Stephen Follin performing the Copper Plate Reel. Did he go, John, looking for links to, say, the bluegrass selection that we heard earlier this hour, or what was his interest in Europe?
No, that's something that came later. That was in Ireland, and we now call those kind of things verite recordings to celebrate them, but at the time it was very difficult to filter out the noise of the place, and they were often finding themselves recording with loud fireplace noises, cracklings, and what have you. But charming in their own respect now, but at the time it drove him crazy. I think he sort of discovered, he certainly knew that there were songs in all the parts of England that had arrived in the U.S. He was thoroughly aware of that, and he even went in his early field trips carrying some of the books that collected these things to show the continuity of them. But the idea that would lead to skiffle, and skiffle, I should say, was a kind of half pop, half folk music, which was made famous mostly by Lonnie Donegan, who had some hits, I guess, up into the 60s even, and was the first British singer to get on the U.S. sales charts. But Donegan got where he was by taking Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie songs and putting strong bass rhythms to them and drums and so forth, but otherwise keeping the song exactly the same as it was, including the little patter or repartee that went before the song started, which infuriated Alan. But at the same time, he saw the power of this thing, and he did form his own skiffle band. And the skiffle we know now is virtually every British star from the 60s and 70s, even into the 80s, was a member of a skiffle band. I'm thinking of people like all the members of Led Zeppelin, two of the members of the Beatles, David Bowie, Van Morrison, go down the line. Oh, and the Rolling Stones.
How good a musician was Alan Lomax?
He would have said that he was only an amateur and was not a very good singer, and did, in fact, only sing when he had to demonstrate something or when he was broke and got some kind of a thing. But he wasn't a singer per se, and I don't think ever performed. He did some recordings, but he was quick to always try to get someone else to do the recordings. The first time he was offered a contract with RCA, which is a big-time company, then he suggested Woody Guthrie, who he had just met, and Guthrie got the gig that was offered him. But I thought he was a charming singer. He had a very fast vibrato, which was not typical of a Texas singer, but nonetheless effective.
Did he ever try to conceal the sound of Texas in his voice?
Oh, absolutely not. This is interesting and fascinating to me. And I was with him in Texas, in El Paso, as I recall, and which is quite a different story, but he didn't conceal the fact that he'd been to the North either. When Pete Seeger, who knew him when Seeger was only a teenager, 17 or 18, in New York, said that they'd be walking down Fifth Avenue, certainly then, maybe now still the most fashionable street in New York, Alan would break into some song and loudly proclaim about it. He never tried to change. It's not that he had a terribly strong regional accent, but it was identifiable. And anyone who's been around New York, particularly those who've been around New York for a long time, would know that New York has a tradition of people becoming the ultimate bohemians and denying they were ever from anywhere across the river. So they were fine to put their family, their state, and everything behind them, but Alan never did that. He talked to his father. He talked about Texas. I'm trying to think now. We were in El Paso. We went to a really below average chili joint, as I recall, and he had sideburns and a goatee. Not that startling, maybe for the '60s, but startling enough. And I realized that he had become the subject of discussion in the chili place. But Alan, picking this up, just talked all the louder. And
John Swed is my guest. He is the author of the new book, Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World. He's also professor of music and jazz studies at Columbia University. We'll be back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Snip of No More Love for You, a recording made when Alan Lomax was working in the Caribbean. You're listening to Think on KERA.org. I'm speaking this hour with John Swed. And John, I played that clip because I wanted to talk about the fact that when Lomax went to the Caribbean, he had a very different experience than he had had as a white man traveling through the Black American South.
This is something that he'd first experienced going to the Bahamas when he was 17 or 18, with Zora Neale Hurston and Mary Louise Barnacle, a professor at NYU in New York, New York University, who was one of the first people to teach folklore courses and actually had very large classes of them. And he felt that for the first time in his life, he doesn't actually say this, but he had the feeling that he was saying that he felt like he was being treated as an equal with people who were African-American, that the distance between them was something that bothered him. And I noticed that when he talked about Black communities when he was in his 20s at formal events at the Library of Congress, he would speak of Southern communities as being fragmented by race and people being lonely for their neighbors and contact the neighbors that they were prevented to know. It was an odd way to put that, but it gives you a sense of how he thought about things. And he felt that he was freed by these experiences in the Caribbean, even more so, despite the fact that there was a history of certainly a strong history of slavery in the Caribbean.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I've gosh, I've been curious about his career for years. I'm curious to know, here's a guy who took his recorder all over the world, all over the United States. Did he ever come to some conclusion of what an American was, character-wise? And related to that, it seems like he had no ethnocentric view of American music. One music seemed to be the same as all the others, and I was wondering if you could comment on those two things. Thank you.
On the latter point, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, one day during, let's say, maybe early 70s, late 60s, there was a lot of to-do about race and culture, which is to say one kind of culture dominating the other and where the education system ran and so forth. And I remember in some of these events where this was being discussed publicly, people would make some sort of statement one way or the other about the minority cultures should have more rights, to be better represented and so on, but then also that there was a stronger and better culture. And Alan would always say he wanted no part of any culture that rose at the expense of another culture. And he would drive that home again and again. And I think he was very conscious of that, in spite of the fact that on a number of occasions earlier in his life, he did say that the finest music produced in America was black music. And it was evident by his taste this was so, and the list he made up, the recommendations he made. But when it came to formal things, he drew the line. The more he traveled the world, he didn't go everywhere. He didn't go to Asia. He didn't go to Africa below Morocco. He didn't go to India, although he had recordings of those things under his name put out by other people. And he didn't go to South America beyond Middle America. He nonetheless had enormous exposure to these things, and I don't for a second think I'd be wrong in saying that he heard more music than anyone alive, even now. In spite of our exposure to things, his library was staggering, as was his dance music, the dance collection. He built the two largest collections in the world and now at the Library of Congress. And I say that because I know no one has gone through those collections on their own, other than the people who worked with him, even yet. And they lie there in wait of him, because you've got to figure out the real-time investment is that's going to be a lifetime. So unless you've got some way to justify it to yourself, it's a tough way to go. Yeah, he seemed to be American music. He couldn't get over the fact that American music was dominating the world's music, and that you could find elements of all sorts of things in America and every other part of the world. You could find the blues turning up in Japan and South Asia and God knows where else. And he had mixed feelings, I think. This is only a thought, because at times it would come out this way, that the mixture of things in America was its greatness. He was not making biological references here. He's just talking about the hybrid nature of it, the strength of this hybridity and so on. On other occasions, though, I have to say, he would back away and say, if only so-and-so had continued with the tradition of his people. He said that about Jelly Roll Morton to me one day and puzzled the hell out of me. He said I was using the word Creole too loosely, and I said, well, you're the guy who wrote a book about Jelly Roll Morton with the word Creole in the title, and you stressed the strength of the Creole tradition mixing together black and white materials and so forth. And then he said, but Jelly Roll Morton could have been even greater if he'd stuck to his own music. I was exact opposite of what he would have said on another day. Well, he was large and contained contradictions, that's all I can say about it.
His early time with Jelly Roll Morton could make a book in itself, just the account of those days. Can you talk about sort of what happened? Initially, am I correct, he really didn't think that Jelly Roll was necessarily worthy of having recordings made, and then he ended up having this extraordinary oral history experience.
Yeah, you have to sort of see the time. As I said, recordings were beginning to spread widely and spread by radio, regional radio, which there were more stations then than there are now, and far more diverse and run by all kinds of local people with local taste. And so he was afraid of the reach of the powerful stations, of which many were in Mexico, where they weren't under the same licensing system. So they could. I was in Labrador, and I found Eskimos who knew the Carter Family songs from WWVA in Wheeling. Just extraordinary that this it spread so far. And recordings were spreading it even further. I forgot how I get into this.
The Jelly Roll Morton.
Yeah, well, so he thought that, that popular music, and particularly jazz in the broad sense of the word, pop, jazz at that point was a pop music, was threatening all these traditions and would wipe them out. So when he heard about Morton, he put him down to be just another one of these people, even though he was an older musician and what have you, when, and he heard about him performing at a dive in D.C. But one day he showed up at the library and announced himself. He came in an old Cadillac, parked in front. You could do it those days. Came in with a very, what Lomax's sister called a very sharp suit, but well-worn, looking good in spite of its age, and said, my name is Jelly Roll Morton. I invented jazz. And that's not what he said. He said, I was the first person to play jazz. Well, I'm not sure what he said, but something of that order. And that I've, people have been stealing my music, and I'm here to tell my story. Huh. And the way Lomax told it was that he was taken by the guy's arrogance and his style and thought, well, let's see what he does know. And then when they set up the machine to record, and Alan asked him, do you know Alabama Bound? He said, I'd never heard a song this well-performed, this full and stylishly. He said, plus this guy talked English in a way that was, well, it's not English or Shakespearean, it had that same quality. So he's completely blown away by this, and when he found out that Morton was willing to keep talking, he recorded him for a month and a half.
What sort of style did Lomax have when he was doing these oral history interviews?
In his interviews?
Yeah.
At that point, he had a standard procedure, which was to keep the recording machine behind you, so it wasn't an obvious fact, and sit at the feet of the person who were performing, literally on the floor, which is partly so he could have the machine behind him and change the disc by reaching back. But he would maintain eye contact with the performer all the way through, and he would lead into the songs very conversationally. That is, when they began to record, he would say, do you know any songs about so-and-so? And he would comment on this. And then afterwards, he'd continue this. So it was a flowing conversation. And when it was a sustained recording event, he said it had a kind of, he thought it was kind of a psychoanalytic event in that it was someone free to talk to someone who wasn't introducing contradictions or arguing or presenting their point of view, just reinforcing and drawing you out. Later, he moved to what I'm sure even he thought were probably extreme at one point. He then got the idea when he was in Spain and Italy that it would help to touch the person while they were performing, to keep a hand on their shoulder or arm. And he made a point of saying, even if they didn't like you, and especially if they didn't like you, he thought this was important. He didn't do this afterwards, but he was working through various phases of that kind.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Jim in Dallas now. Hi, Jim.
Thanks. I just had a question.
Hello.
There's a large and extensive and eclectic collection of Americana at the Harry Ransom Museum in Austin, and I was wondering if any of this collection is there.
What do you know about that, John?
I'm sorry, I lost the first part of that.
He was asking whether any of Lomax's works are at the Harry Ransom Museum in Austin.
The writings, or
I guess he's probably talking about recordings. Most of them are at the Library of Congress. Is that right?
I think I've looked at that material. I think there are. Yes, they are. Now, anything he has there would be at the Library of Congress too, unless I'd be surprised if I just put it that way. And they are available, as you suggested, online to some degree, and can be gotten that way. And I'm thinking fast. I do know that the writings that are there, the letters and so forth, are those that are internal to the family. Everything else that he wrote is now in Washington.
How much of what became the folk revival has to do with Alan Lomax's interests and his tastes? And did he record according to his taste, or did he sort of take everything he could and take a Catholic approach to what he wanted to get on recording?
I think early on the idea was to record anything that looked recordable. In fact, when he worked in places where there was money to pay people, and increasingly it was because he argued for that at the Library of Congress near the end of his stay there, and then on his other trips he always paid people. He paid them even if he thought the songs weren't very good and they didn't record them, which is pretty extraordinary. And I think after a while, he'd heard everything. Once in a while, something would pop up, at least in this country, that was new. And after a while, and touring in places like Italy and so on, not that he could hear everything they did, but he heard enough to get the feel of it. His taste, well, it's interesting. One of the last times I was with him for a live event was for Professor Longhair, the New Orleans singer and piano player who plays in a kind of now more of a standard-type New Orleans style, but it's one that combines Caribbean rhythms, Cuban rhythms, boogie-woogie, and black church music and other things. And you can hear really strange combinations, things I thought Lomax would have hated, like sitting in this club in New York where Longfair was performing, and he was doing Hank Williams tunes, Jambalaya and that sort of thing, with this rumbling Latin boogie rhythm underneath, which is to say he was putting together Cajun, black, Caribbean, God knows what. And I thought Lomax would hate it. And at one point, he got up and crawled across the floor right up to the bandstand, sat there, crouching at it with his hands on it, like if people remember this figure, Kilroy, who World War II figure that was popping up in pictures with his head in his hands looking over something. And then when the set was over, he got up and came back through the crowd saying, greatest musician in the Western world. And I thought, God, I thought sure he would hate this. And then he even wrote a letter to the Village Voice telling people that this guy is the basis for Fats Domino and all sorts of rock and roll. In fact, Alan was a huge rock and roll fan, I have to add. Despite everyone's insistence that he was a purist, he was crazy about rock and roll, especially Elvis.
Do you know what he listened to when he just had half an hour to kick back at home?
Pardon me?
Did he have just produced records to listen to when he was home, or did he go through his own recordings and find things?
When he was at home. Well, the thing is that he was seldom at home.
Yeah.
And I once asked him, by the way, since you were about Texas before, could he have done what he did by living in Texas rather than New York? And he said no, for two reasons. One, he could get more done in New York and in a day than you could do in a month in Texas. This is pre-web and pre-cell phone, so maybe that was true. And then he muttered something about a sheriff in some county or other. I want to say boy, but I'm not sure. Threatening him and saying, if he ever came back, he's going to cut his throat.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but that's a good story.
I'm connecting bowie knives, I'm afraid, here. That's not a good connection.
John Swett's new book is called Alan Lomax, The Man Who Recorded the World. John, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for me, too.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.